Books and turn to page 5. Page 5 in the songbook, we'll do one verse and two choruses of Ever Onward on page 5 of the songbook.
There's a thrill in store for all, for we're about to toast the corporation that's in every land. We're here to cheer each pioneer and also proudly boast of that man, a man, our friend and guiding hand. The name of T.J. Watson means the courage none can stem, and we feel honored to be here to toast the
first chorus.
Ever onward, ever onward, that's the spirit that has brought us fame. We're big, but bigger we will be. We can fail, for all can see that to serve humanity has been our aim.
Within American history, few eras are as dizzy with change as the decades bounded by Reconstruction and World War II. The Civil War swept away the beliefs and assumptions of a previous generation, and for the next half century, the nation would watch in wonder as modern America took its distinctive shape. Among the headline changes in this period was a revolution in business and corporate culture. And as our guest this week argues, the transformation of the American workplace did not merely alter the economic landscape of the nation, but also affected class, race, and gender dynamics as well. David Leverance is professor of English at the University of Florida. He is author of Manhood and the American Renaissance and The Language of Puritan Feeling. His most recent work, Paternalism Incorporated, Fables of American Fatherhood, 1865 to 1940, was published in 2003 by Cornell University Press. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. That brief opening, I think, is at least a bit misleading, as your work seems less an examination of economics or working conditions, and much more on how the rise of a corporate capitalistic structure impacted American society. Is that a fair assessment?
It certainly is. I don't do any archival research, though I rely a lot on business narratives. But I am particularly interested in how changes in middle-class white men's working conditions affected conceptions of fatherhood, individualism, honor. And it also made it possible for women to enter the bureaucratic workplace and eventually develop professional careers. And my basic argument is that paternalism was a kind of transitional structure that controlled the threat and promise of these changes and developments. Angel Qualick-Foland, a colleague of mine at University of Florida, says that a fourth of the male laboring population was white collar by 1920, and Clark Davis in Company Men says that by 1925, one-third of white-collar workers were women, usually in very low clerical positions. That's an incredible cultural change, and I've been trying to look at some of the cultural ramifications of it.
Well, it's also a topic that hasn't got much scholarly attention. Why don't you lead us into this story? What questions brought you to this project?
Partly it was a kind of annoyance that a lot of people on the left were just dismissing capitalism out of hand. I thought things were much more complex. But then there were four or five questions that sort of converged. One was simply upward mobility narratives. There were almost none before the Civil War, and there was an enormous flood right after. That clearly had something to do with corporate capitalism. And the more original one is I noticed that in a lot of narratives, the Gilded Age, Sister Carrie, O Pioneers, ambitious young women were being presented as daddy's girls. And I thought that was really weird. Did Gene Webster's Daddy Long Legs. I have a whole chapter just on those four. And the obvious thing would be that it made women's ambition seem safer and more deferential, but it also articulated the possibility of it. One of the most interesting things that I think I discovered is that again and again, a great variety of narratives expose midlife paternalistic men as shaky, feeling that they'd failed at something, a kind of lack in the middle of their paternalism. One little thing that got me going along those lines is it blew my mind that Grant Wood's American Gothic has a father and a daughter. in that painting. And it makes it so much more ambiguous.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, that led to all sorts of other things. Daddy's Boys, a chapter on that, and why did businessman and the firm become such central cultural concepts? And then I got launched on why did rich men like Carnegie and Rockefeller want to give away so much of their money? So there were a lot of different questions, and they all converged into paternalism.
Well, key to all of that work, as you just suggest, is that notion of paternalism. And I think in today's America, that term has a negative and perhaps even ugly connotation. Give me a history. Has it always been so?
Yes and no. I mean, right now, paternalism is somewhere between boring and a four-letter word, and that's certainly right. It worried me all along about the topic. But at least in my reading of it, paternalism, the basic meaning of it is that it applies to any social practice modeled on the ideal care that a father gives a dependent child. And I'm arguing that it inheres in any structure of inequality, and those structures will always be with us, or at least as far as I can see. And in the South, they made it a great virtue, their care of the slaves, the whites did. And in antebellum artisan shops, ditto, it presumes a stable hierarchy of deference and mutual obligations. And corporations took over that rhetoric to discipline and control their workplaces. The big change, of course, is that in large managerial bureaucracies, the rhetoric of family just doesn't quite hold anymore. And Jane Addams's essay, A Modern Lear, in 1894, wonderfully exposes the kind of shaky narcissism of George Pullman's almost futile desire for gratitude, as she puts it. It just doesn't work in large institutions, and it leads to a lot of anti-union work. And that still persists in some elite institutions today. Let's say English departments that are opposing graduate student unions. That's still a rhetoric that's alive and well.
Well, let's see if we can make this a little bit more concrete. Help me understand what the link is then between these larger developments in American capitalism and these ever-changing notions of paternalism.
Well, at one level, it's a field for expansion. I mean, this is the era of the great white father. Actually, this maybe goes beyond your question, but I see a relatively straight line between the Dawes Act, 1887, which tries to make Indians into property-holding individuals, and what's going on now in the Middle East as our government is trying to transform Iraq and perhaps even Iran into democracies along our own model. And there's a paternalistic edge to that in a much more national or international field. And it also obviously helps to control and discipline the workplace as women and immigrants enter the workplace at the bottom. And there's just lots of complex, contrary swirlings in it, I think. It shores up midlife managers' self-images, it firms them up, shall we say, and it preserves men's feelings of father-like care in an increasingly impersonal workplace. So I see it as a large transitional moment that hasn't yet ended.
Well, you hit on a very critical point there, because within that structure, within these changing definitions of paternalism, there are tons of paradoxes and ironies. So it seems to me that American men would be given confusing and sometimes even conflicting messages about what role they were supposed to fulfill in society.
Absolutely. And those messages haven't stopped either. A man should be a rugged individualist, but a man should be a team player. You should be assertive and inventive, but you should know your place in the corporate structure. One of the most interesting ones is that you should be a good father at home, but also put more time into your career. One of the things that struck me is that American narratives, there are no narratives like Silas Marner or Trollope's Dr. Thorne, where you have a father raising a young child or a daughter in particular. Typically, at least in James, if you have a father raising a child alone, Gilbert Osmond in Portrait of a Lady or Dr. Sloper in Washington Square, he's evil. He's bad. And even Adam Verwer in The Golden Bowl, who has raised his daughter, you don't see that. You see Maggie, in a sense, raising him at this point. So there's a real sense that a middle-class father should be basically absorbed in work, yet should have some primacy at home. So I think those are lots of tensions, a lot of tensions for women, too, I think.
Well, within those tensions, there's also an idea that paternalism isn't only going to influence the requirements for individual behavior, but also larger, much larger sometimes, political structures or cultural structures. For example, you have a link between changing definitions of paternalism and ideas of race in America.
Yeah, this is one of my more untenable arguments, I think. This giving and shaming chapter I have on white philanthropy led me into the idea that white racism at the turn of the century may be a kind of collective shaming to keep blacks in their place once the threat emerged of real equality. I call it a modern contact period. Du Bois talks somewhere about the increased interaction between the races leading to intensified virulent feelings of racism. So I think this shaming is a way of preserving and perhaps even extending paternalistic structures of superiority and inferiority and prevent that equality and mixing. And I'd see that all over the place in literature of the period, especially the ways that in some ways black people internalize shame.
I agree. And those national ideas of supremacy that you mentioned that have a very concrete place in American race relations, I think as you suggested earlier with the events in the Middle East and Iraq in particular, that it may be possible to take this dynamic much further. And can you speak for just a second on how these guidelines for personal action sometimes became part of the national political agenda as well?
Well, I'm not so sure about political agenda, except the Great White Father image. And actually, that was enormously conflicted. Andrew Carnegie opposed imperialism in the Philippines, but on rather paternalistic and even racist grounds. As he said at one point, Americans can't be grown there. They just have to go their own way because they're inferior to Americans. It led to an enormous stress on passing narratives among African-American narratives. Just been reading James Weldon Johnson's autobiography of an ex-colored man. Students have been astonished that he doesn't get angry when people affiliate him with blackness. He could pass for white. He just gets deeply shamed and chooses to pass because he doesn't want to be affiliated with blackness. The whole uplift narratives, upward mobility to try to uplift yourself to semi-white status. So it certainly affects imperialism, but I think it also affects more in corporate terms, the ongoing, what Clark Davis calls the Anglo enclave of top corporate executives in the middle of an increasingly multicultural society. I'm not sure that that gets what you mean by politics.
I think it does. And I think it speaks to much of these larger issues of how the tentacles of paternalism can extend deep into American culture. Well, let's sort of return more to the central focus of your text. And while these messages of paternalism were delivered in many forms, you argue that most often, or perhaps even most powerfully, these messages were delivered through literature. Why use literature as the vehicle to get to these different messages?
To qualify that, it's most powerful to me because it's what I know. I would certainly argue, and I think I said somewhere in there, that advertising or movies or architecture or any great range of things to people who really have sensibility that responds to it centrally would show just as much. But literature is what I think about. I mean, the book does end with Shirley Temple's Little Colonel,
right?
So it's one movie anyway. But it's basically, literature is a lens, and this may get at my own midlifing that's partly prompted the book, to expose with a kind of distanced pitying the shakiness about achievement, about am I more interchangeable than I think I am. Also, Hurstwood and Gesicha Carey becomes a kind of primary feeling. To get at what a workaholic culture does to a whole variety, again, of white middle-class men. And literature really opens that up with a surprising degree of sympathy. I was really surprised at that. Even from women writers like Edith Wharton or Willa Cather, there's an intimate connection between feelings of failure and paternalistic solace for a lot of men. And that intrigued me.
Okay. Well, within your examination of many of these authors that are members of the American canon, from Mark Twain and Theodore Dreiser to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and you just mentioned Willa Cather, within their classic works, are there standard formulas or are there stock characters that readers should recognize as delivering a particular message about paternalism or roles that men and women should take in America?
Well, they probably are, but I think I missed them. One thing that immediately comes to mind is actually probably tangential, and that is that when women writers are writing, let's say Kate Chopin and The Awakening or Edith Wharton's Summer, they will sometimes demonize women professionals as, let's say, Mademoiselle Reese in The Awakening or Dr. Merkel, the abortion doctor in Summer. There's a real animus against particularly Dr. Merkel. So there's something that's a recurrent motif. Actually, James even does that in Portrait with Henrietta Stackpole, his creative double. So that's one kind of distancing. And the other is again and again this sense of Hurstwood or Lawyer Royal in Summer or Dick Diver in Tender as the Night, this sense that as this move towards feelings of failure and inadequacy and chronicling some sense of kind of downward turn to that. But mostly what I'm just emphasizing is an extraordinary variety of paternalisms, from Longfellow's Children's Hour to Mark Twain's angelfish letters to Lolita. There's a whole sub-incest theme in a variety of these. Eve's Bayou is a nice movie in the late 90s. So I could see this sense of how paternalism becomes a kind of solace that has quite negative consequences for the people you're, if I can coin a phrase, paternalizing, but seems to be solacing the men. If that's a standard formula, that might be one.
Well, building off those standard formulas or even those reoccurring motifs, your study concludes in 1940, but can you still see a powerful impact of paternalism on modern America?
Well, I can think of a couple. Again, I mentioned the elite colleges that see faculty-grad-student relations in an apprentice model. And there's still ongoing Imperial America, Great White Father, Chapter 38, with a kind of added dimension there that white middle-class Americans were just shocked by 9/11. We experienced terror as a kind of national humiliation or victimization. I don't think that was true for many black people who knew terror from way back. But I think a lot of what this current election is about is the continuing to restore a feeling of national dominance, collective feeling of prowess, by kicking some international butt, and it really doesn't matter whose butt. And I think that Republicans have basically run with that narrative with great success over the last 2002 election, and I suspect, obviously my bias is the other way, but I suspect it will happen in this election too. And they've caught hold of that national narrative of collective imaginary dominance at some expense to individual voters' self-interest, and that rather baffles and depresses me, frankly.
I completely understand your sentiment. Well, thank you, David. I very much enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to David Leverance, author of Paternalism Incorporated, Fables of American Fatherhood, 1865 to 1940, published by Cornell University Press. This is Talking History.